Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. Stone, how you doing?
Good morning, sir. I am doing well. Jazzed. It's first day of spring. Have I got that right?
That's right. There was a rumor to that effect. I celebrated by bringing a heavy jacket.
Nicely done. So this is going to be a great segment. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with Brad Christian. He's managing director with Market Force. And we're also going to talk to author and CEO of Seven Mindsets, Jeff Waller. But first up, on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the president of Southeast Mortgage, which is reputed to be the largest non-bank lender of Georgia. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Mr. J.D. Crow. How you doing, man?
Fantastic. How are you?
I am doing well. So this is for real, largest non-bank lender of Georgia. How'd you pull that off,
Dan? Is that like size of building? How are we determining largest?
I believe it's by number of employees and volume of loans. We are the largest independent mortgage banker in Georgia.
Wow.
So now, can you talk about the Atlanta housing market? How are we doing?
Surprisingly, it's doing a lot better than I think most people give credit to. What we have seen recently is that prices are really coming back over the last year and a half. And the biggest challenge right now is inventory. I think that a lot of consumers don't realize that prices have come back. And so the
come back means get higher.
Get better, yes.
Higher
yes.
for the person selling.
Exactly.
Because there was a period, right, when they were depressed and then companies were coming in like and buying blocks of bankrupt houses and
yes.
things like that, right?
Exactly. And a lot of investors made a lot of money over the last few years coming in buying really low. Those prices having come back to higher levels, a lot of places, even the levels that we saw prior to the crash. And so I think that if that message can get out, then we have a lot more people that are willing to sell their homes and move, either downsize or go to the next size house up with their growing families or whatever. And so it seems to me, being in the industry every day, that that is not a common belief, and people don't understand.
So people still think that it's depressed and that they're not going to make any money on their house, and
exactly.
so they just might as well stick
They may have listed their house 2 years ago and been slapped in the face with a reality that they had lost a lot of the equity that they had, if they had any at the beginning.
Right.
And so people have just sat and said, okay, well, I can't move. Maybe I'll do a little renovation. Maybe
I'm going to just stick it out here, and then I'll just try to make the best of it.
Exactly.
But so now, you think now there's a...
It's a great time to sell your house. Most everybody I talk to has backup offers.
Backup offers. Wow. So that is a big change, isn't it?
It's a big change. And listings will go on the market day one. Within hours, they're under contract. Hours. Same day.
Wow.
It's amazing.
So our producer, Kevin, is engaged to his beautiful fiance, Rebecca. It won't be too long before they're probably shopping for a mortgage. He's rolling in the cash here, so he'll have a decent down payment. But what kind of mistakes can we expect Kevin and other folks to make when they begin to prepare to engage somebody to help them with a mortgage? I bet you've seen it all.
We've seen it all. I just off the top of my head, there's a couple that I see more often than not, or more often than others. And a lot of people don't understand that moving money around can create some significant challenges for you. If you got three bank accounts and you're moving money from one to another, it just creates a documentation nightmare.
So now the person who does that is thinking, oh, they'll just cobble them together and they'll add that up, and then that's what it is.
Exactly.
But that may not be how it's seen.
With the advent of the Patriot Act a few years back, every dollar has to be tracked to ensure that there's no money laundering, no terrorist activity. I mean, it's just
wow.
crazy. But
do you know something about Kevin that you're not telling us?
Innocently moving money from a savings account to a checking account and then wiring money from one checking account to another just creates a paper trail
right.
that we have to document from the inception of where that money first came from. Another one is that people will go out and get new credit during the mortgage process. So they apply for the mortgage and
buy a car at the same time?
Buy
that's
a car.
Probably not good either, right?
Yeah.
Or even just start asking about a car loan is enough to pull
exactly.
to trigger, right? You
know, exactly. It may not create another debt, but it creates another inquiry on the credit report, which we will see. And then we have to go back and ask again, well, what did you do? Why were you at General Motors? Why were you at Ford, whatever?
And so now the time to close and things like that takes makes it longer, right?
It adds more documentation.
More complexity to the process. It doesn't have to be that complex. Now, if you were going to do any of that, moving things around, getting maybe some money from a family member, how far in advance should you be doing that before you start looking for a mortgage? Is that like 6 months to a year ahead of time?
The further in advance, the better. But typically, when we're in the process, we need 2 months of bank statements. Mm-hmm. So if whatever money is in that bank account 2 months before you start the process,
you care less, right?
We don't need to see that.
Uh-huh.
So 2 months of history, any deposits during that 2 month period, we have to document.
Right.
Anything that's in there before that, we don't care about.
Right.
Now, there's a colleague or two, especially here in the Metro Atlanta market, that are also in this business. How do you go about differentiating yourself?
That's a great question. We really, really try to hammer home that service matters. A lot of consumers today, I think, want a Nordstrom experience at a Walmart price.
Mm-hmm.
And what we try to do is kind of meet in the middle. We give them that experience that they're looking for, hold their hand all the way through the process, give them great advice up front and a very, very smooth process, and let them know these are the pitfalls that you may find yourself in if you don't do these things. Rather than just letting the mistakes happen, letting somebody move money around during the process or go try to get another credit line opened, we'll tell them all of those things up front, and we actually have a disclosure that says, don't do this, 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 or this during the process.
That's helpful. That's what I need is the don't list.
Right. There's a to-do list and a to-don't list.
Exactly. Exactly. And don't miss a payment on something else, because if this...
So people
like
do that?
Advice,
they're about to close on like this, the biggest investment they have, and then they'll do something silly like that?
Especially in today's market. We will pre-approve someone before they've even found a home. So we have...
So that way they have an idea so that when it's time to do the deal, they're ready to go.
Exactly. To the point of running them all the way through the underwriting process. Credit, income, assets, everything is approved. And then they've just got to get that house under contract,
right?
Because it's taking so long now because there's not enough inventory. So by the time they get to the point, well, we've got to pull credit again. They missed a payment. Their credit score dropped. Now they've got a different interest rate.
And now the wheels have come off, right?
Exactly.
Well, and that's something that I wanted to bring up as well. Let's say that Holly and I know that we want to start looking at buying a home maybe August, September. We shouldn't be waiting till late July to try to build a relationship with a mortgage person, right? We should at least go ahead and get to know them and start having a conversation now, right?
Absolutely. The sooner the better.
Because there's all these things that you can help us think through. Okay, here's what you need to do with respect to your financial life over the next several months. So speaking of relationships, there's this whole, you got your mortgage person, but there's also, you got the closing attorney, you got the real estate people. Do you guys kind of hang out together and team up? And do you have some go-to people in each? Yeah?
For sure. There are, and as in every industry, you have experts and you have average. And we try to associate ourselves through every step of the process and every area of business that intersects with those professionals.
And then that helps the home buyer because there's a pile of trusted advisors that come along for the ride, right?
Exactly.
And the quarterback is typically the real estate person?
In general, that's typically what we see is because mm-hmm. when someone's starting a search for a home, that's who they call first, and then you bring everyone else in.
Right. So you must work closely with real estate
Certainly.
People all over.
Yes. And what we would like to do is have people get pre-approved really early in the process. Most of the agents that we work with, before they even start taking someone out to look at a home, they're going to call us, hey, run their credit, check their income, make sure they've got the money to close before I go spend hours and hours and hours driving these people around to look at homes.
Now, what about online? How has that impacted things? I mean, there was a period of time, you know, before the housing crisis where it was like everywhere you turn, there was online mortgage solutions. It can't be as easy as they make it seem.
It's not, and that's where I was talking about that level of service.
Right.
Most people think they're going to get a quote online, and it's going to look a little cheaper than what they got from Southeast Mortgage, for
instance. Like a human being.
Exactly.
Right.
And then they realize 15 days after they were supposed to close that there's a reason they were paying just a little bit more to have someone that they could actually interact with throughout the process.
And it's hard, I'm sure, when you're at the closing table and you have your my smartphone going, this is my mortgage person, right? And then mm-hmm. there's a problem, and then I'm trying to email the guy or call them. It's probably a little less effective, I would imagine.
Yeah, we like to actually go to our closings. Most of our loan originators go to their closings to ensure that that process from start to finish, all the way through the handing over the keys, was absolutely perfect.
Now, has there been a weeding out of some of these less scrupulous mortgage people?
For sure. There are 80% less mortgage companies in Georgia today than there were prior to
80%.
80%.
Wow.
That's huge.
That's stunning.
So tell us about this 8-day close thing you got going.
That's kind of our key to success, is that every loan from start to finish, we want it approved for closing in 8 days. Now, that takes a lot of coordination, and it takes a lot of...
you must have good systems and process to pull that off.
Yeah, I would say we're the best at that.
Well, we're back at this Nordstrom conversation versus the Walmart conversation,
exactly.
Right?
And the 8-day close, most people don't need to close in 8 days. They write 30-day contracts. We just want, for the consumers, you know, partner with us. If we're asking for something, give it to us, because we're not asking for no reason. Especially if someone hasn't done a mortgage in the last few years, the process is a little different. We actually need your income documents and need you to see that you
have... I can't do it over the phone?
You
take my word for it?
You can do most of it over the phone, but we're still going to need some documentation from you.
You don't take my word for it. Wow.
They're going to hang up on you when you tell them you're a radio host.
Right.
Maybe you should rent, Mr. Cantor.
They did call them liar loans for a reason.
Well, there was a period then that was how that was done, right?
Absolutely. And I think that people who went through that process, even if they had verifiable income and assets 10 years ago, it was just so easy. They didn't have to provide them. Today, we ask for everything except your blood type. And when you're going through that and your last experience was so simple,
right?
It seems very intrusive. And what I would say to anyone listening is that, you know, the mortgage loan originator doesn't get paid if we don't close. They're not going to ask you for anything that they don't need.
Right.
I mean, they're your partner.
You're trying to close the deal too.
Absolutely.
We're all, you know, on the same team here.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your backstory. How did you land here?
Oh, goodness. That's a long story. But I went to school at Furman University in South Carolina. One of my good friends there was in Atlanta. I went through ROTC. I was an officer in the Army, and when I was getting out of the Army 6 years after college, was coming to Atlanta to take a job. And this friend of mine, who's still here, said, "You know, we're still friends."
Okay.
Said we're starting a mortgage division within our financial planning firm, and would love for you to help us out with that. And I knew I had a mortgage. That was the only thing I knew about them at the time. from there, next couple of years, became a partner in the firm, ran a mortgage division, and became active in the Mortgage Brokers Association. And then about 4 years ago, went to Southeast Mortgage, this year, I'm now the president of the company.
Yeah, you're the chief mohawk, right?
I mean, you must be doing something right.
Your career is like on this incredibly steep curve. So we were talking a little bit earlier in the conversation about differentiation. Speak a little bit more to how the whole sales and marketing piece of running a mortgage organization works, because I get the sense that you can't just go out knocking on doors or picking up the phone. Is a lot of it relationships through these other players we were talking about? How does that work?
You know, there's a lot of different ways. You know, we mentioned online, we mentioned relationships. For us, it's absolutely about relationships. Whether it's builders or realtors or real estate agents or financial planners or CPAs or attorneys, professionals who have other relationships with potential clients of ours, that's who we're partnering with. We are 90% of our business is purchase business. Over the last few years.
So it's, not refinance?
Correct. Because we do refinances, sure. But it's just that this market now has transitioned completely. You know, it was the 70% of the business in the nation last year was refinance business. It's flipped.
It's flipped now.
It's now 70%. We're higher than that because we want to partner with referral sources and make their lives easier.
And they have to be philosophically aligned because it seems like that's important to you. If
exactly.
you want to be Nordstrom, not every real estate person wants to be Nordstrom.
Well, we would hope that everyone wants that experience.
Right. Though. But they're not, you know, you're choosing people that are aligned philosophically with
exactly.
your ethics and the way that you guys do business.
Exactly. If all you're looking for is the absolute lowest rate and the cheapest cost, be prepared for the service that goes with that.
Goes with that. Sure.
Yeah. That could make for a really cool segment sometime, though. Like to have you guys come in, you or someone on your team come in, maybe you know a closing attorney that you really trust, a realtor that you've had great success with, and just kind of talk through that relationship.
Absolutely. We'd love to do that.
Would you be up for that, Lee? I mean, don't you think
that
would make a cool
segment?
Just
right,
like
just show how everything connects.
How it mm-hmm. all works together. So, all right, we'll put something like that together. Before we wrap, where can our listeners go to learn more and have a conversation with us about mortgages with you or someone on your team?
Well, of course, we'd love to have a phone conversation. Our office number is 770-279-0222. And, of course, we have to have a website.
Sure.
That is www.southeastmortgage.com.
And that's Southeast spelled out, right?
Correct.
And no Pinterest.
You know,
we
may have a Pinterest account now.
I just found out what that was like 3 days ago from my 15-year-old. So
I'm
fascinated with all this stuff. Well, it's been an absolute delight having you in the studio. And this idea, this offer is quite sincere. I think that could make for a really informative and fun segment. So we'll talk about putting something like that together.
Sounds great.
Hey, listen, you going to hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
For sure.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have with us Managing Director with Market Force Information, Mr. Brad Christian. How you doing, man?
Brad, I'm doing really well. Thanks.
So what'd you learn in that last segment? You all pumped up and ready for you ready for a mortgage?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. I just jotted down his name and market for the website address.
Looking forward to talking to you.
See that? You're closing sales, man. That's how to do it.
Well, you're on top of it more than me because I started asking the question, and I was looking over here at our author.
That was,
asking him.
I thought you were like a ventriloquist.
Right. But now that I know who I'm talking to, I'll actually look at you while I'm asking the questions.
That works.
Market Force, mission, purpose, what are you out there trying to do for folks?
So Market Force is providing something called customer intelligence, and it's actually a really exciting industry that is relatively new. And it revolves around an issue that has been around for as long as there's been brick-and-mortar retail businesses. But at the end of the day, what our company's doing is providing multi-location businesses with the business intelligence that they need to delight customers and drive financial performance. We provide a series of measurement services that we implement for these businesses to basically help them understand how are they executing on customers' expectations.
And do you see typically a disconnect the way that the organization is thinking it's going and then the way the customer is thinking it's going?
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, fair question. The difficulty really is that there are corporations with the best of intentions, with handbooks and policies and guidelines and expectations on how the location should execute.
Well, there's a mission statement on the wall that's telling them exactly how everybody should be behaving, right?
Absolutely. But the manager of the store, the district manager walks out the front door, and then folks become folks and do what they do, and they don't necessarily execute. And so one of the things that I like to talk about is, you know, businesses need to have measures in place where they can inspect what they expect.
Mm-hmm. And then what are some of the ways they can do that?
So there's a series of services that a company like Market Force provides in this umbrella of customer intelligence. And the first two are fairly tactical, and the second two are a little more strategic in nature. But the first one is, as I mentioned, sort of giving you the ability to inspect what you expect. It's very operationally focused, and it's really objective. Were you greeted? Were you thanked? You know, was the restroom clean? Did you find what you were looking for? And things like mystery shopping and operational audits are the way that we get at those kind of questions.
So you send people in to just be a customer and see what happens?
Absolutely. We have 300,000 of these customers that we work with across North America to go into everything from banks to retailers to restaurants, et cetera.
Sign me up. I want to do that. I think maybe for Mexican restaurants.
Have you been like a mystery shopper before?
I actually have. Yeah. One of the conditions of actually coming to work for Market Force is that you have to go out and get an appreciation for what it's like to assess a retail experience. And so I've gone out and with a digital camera and taken pictures of gas stations and whether the pump toppers were in place. And there's a variety of different things that we do as a business that isn't always just customer experience necessarily, but just compliance and meeting standards.
Now, when you're mystery shopping, are you like just a nice person, or are you supposed to be like the, you know, frustrated customer? Like what role are you playing?
So it's all the above, actually. It depends on what the customer, the client, is actually looking to understand and measure. And so the scenario is the term you're using. The scenario can be everything as simple as we just want to make sure that the there's a term in the petro-convenience industry called the bollard. That's the thing that protects you from crashing into the gas pump.
Right.
So the bollard has to be painted a certain color. That's one of the compliance measures.
So you're going, taking a picture.
Taking a picture. You're also going in, and as you mentioned, you're just trying to see what the overall experience is. Did this particular individual follow the corporate sales process? I'm actually going to go in and role play a particular frustration or disappointment and see how that's reacted to by the staff.
Mm-hmm. Man, you think this would work on producers in our studios?
Maybe you are one of them right now.
Exactly.
Well, it is interesting when you get into this industry, what really starts to happen to you is that you can't look at your personal experiences in these locations ever again because you're constantly evaluating right. that way.
So I want to talk a little bit about verticals that this might apply to, or industries or sectors. Obviously, a great deal of application to a lot of retail establishments. You mentioned you had a cool name for it, Petro Convenience.
Yeah.
I used to call them gas stations, but yeah, we
know. Doesn't sound as sexy, right?
No, it doesn't. I like that. Business to business, can this work for like
does
professional
it work for
services
lawyers?
And that kind of thing?
So it's a great question. It's mostly focused in the brick and mortar business. And so, as I mentioned, it's restaurants, it's retailers. And I use restaurants and retailers in the broadest sense of the word. You know, retailers is everything from drugstores to gas stations to supermarkets, et cetera. And then restaurants is everything from casual dining, fast casual, quick serve restaurants.
Is it like the franchise? Like the franchisor hires you?
Well, great question. So sometimes they do, but more often than not, what we do is we get hired by the corporations who have franchised business models, and they need help understanding what's going on across the system, because at the end of the day, a franchisee is its own business and has some latitude on how they run that business, and they've tied into an agreement with the corporation, the franchisor, right. that says, yes, I'll put your sign on the front door, yes, I'll carry your menu items, and you know, yes, I'll do a number of things that you agree to. And unfortunately, as you can imagine, they don't always do those things.
Sure.
So the corporation has a vested interest to protect its brand image, brand equity, brand promise by making sure that these organizations are executing on their standards.
So without the benefit of engaging you guys right out of the box, what are some things that we could all just be doing to get a little better insight into some of these measures? Are there just some basic things that when you look around, you think to yourself, man, they ought to at least be doing this, whether they hire us or not?
Yeah, no, that's fair. So there's a couple of free places to go if you are one of these kinds of businesses, and one of them is the American Customer Satisfaction Index, ACSI, and I think it's theacsi.org, and they rank every industry that you can think of in terms of how are these businesses executing according to customers, you know, just actual customers. So that's a free place to go and just get a sense of where you stand. There's also Market Force, as an example, plug, where we have a benchmark study that we do every year for every industry. So we're just now finishing up launching our casual dining study, and we'll be able to tell. We get about 6,000 respondents who give us feedback. It's a panel survey methodology where we'll find out from them what are their preferences, you know, which organizations are they patronizing more, less, are there particular companies that they've just tried for the first time, and what was that experience like, and how did that experience drive their likelihood to return and, in fact, recommend, make a purchase, you know, et cetera. So those are two very easy places to go. But what's interesting is even if you see how you're doing, you'll find out that there are organizations like public supermarkets, like Chick-fil-A, that do fabulously well in their individual segments. But those organizations are the ones that measure themselves the most.
Right.
So to stay at the top, you have to have you have to be on your A game all the time across every store, every customer. And Stone, going back to one of the questions you asked me earlier, in terms of the services that we provide, I mentioned the mystery shopping, and that's a really important part of it. But that's really just the objective operational
measure.
Right,
that's just to get data, right?
Yeah, the other side of the equation is the fact that many businesses need to understand, well, does the customer like what we're doing? And so actually using customer satisfaction surveys or having a 1-800 contact center service in place allows them to get that more experiential, subjective perspective that the business needs. And so we kind of talk about that as being the yin and the yang of the customer experience.
Right.
How am I executing? And then does my customer actually like that? So once you get those two together, that's where we get into the third and the fourth part of our offering, which is taking that information and making it a little bit more actionable and a little more strategic in nature. So the third piece is that we will bring the operational measure and the subjective measure, and the type of data that comes back from those are very different. Yeses and nos, scale of 1 to 5, how overall satisfied are you, how likely are you to come back, very different. But when we bring those together through a patented modeling process that we use and link that with financials like same-store sales, average transaction value, et cetera, we start to see some really interesting insights that we share with our clients. And one of the outputs of that process is something we call the criticality index. And at the end of the day, when we model those different behaviors or attributes of the business to KPIs like same-store sales, overall satisfaction, et cetera, we can tell businesses, hey, here's the three things, here's the five things you need to do consistently, because when they take place in your business in combination, you drive the highest levels of ROI that you're looking to drive. And so they can then take that and then drive action on these are the things. Yes, I could, Mr. Franchisee, tell you about 100 things you should be doing, but here's the five.
Right.
If you just do these five things, we can quantify the lift that you should expect as a result.
Now, is there, in a restaurant, clean bathrooms? Like, that's an easy thing, right? Like, everybody wants clean bathrooms. Can you, through your data, as you're getting the data, can you figure out what the company's not doing that maybe the customer wants? Like things, like it's easy to measure things that are there, you know, make the bathrooms clean. Okay, I can fix that. But can you kind of say, well, it would be nice if you did this, maybe in the industry, that would drive more revenue or drive more traffic?
Yes, absolutely. So we have over 300 clients across these different industries that I mentioned. So the benefit of having so many is that we get cross-channel insights.
Right.
And so speaking specifically about the restroom, is the fact that we find that to be what we call a table stake. And so you don't go into a restaurant, as an example, and go, man, oh man, this place has a fantastic bathroom.
I'll be back here next week.
Yeah, right.
Only if you're traveling.
But and it doesn't really meaningfully affect your behavior in terms of your intent to come back. Your hey guys, go to this restaurant. They have a fabulous restroom.
Right.
But because it's a table stake. If you don't get that right, it's punishing.
Right.
And so people will actually consciously say, I don't want to go back there again, because if they don't clean the restroom, what's going on in the kitchen?
Exactly.
So that's one example of what you're referring to. The cross-channel piece that I referenced earlier is the ability to basically understand what are other businesses doing in other industries that maybe has carryover effect that we could start measuring and modeling within your business or your industry and see if there is, in fact, an ROI that can be driven by improvements on particular element of your business.
Now, speaking of restroom, there was a store when I was visiting a candy store in Florida that their restroom was the thing that people would go to because it was clear. Like, you can see in, and as soon as you turn the light on or close the door, it would frost the thing. So people would come in just to go in to see, like, can you see me? And that was the driver of going into the place.
That sounds great. I've not seen that before.
But that's something that differentiates, and that's what things that can bubble up through your work, right?
Well, I think the key to what you're just referencing, and I think what many of the things that our customers, clients are looking to do, is if they already have a brand promise, this is what we want to, you know, JD rather, made the mention of the Walmart versus Neiman Marcus. I mean, that's a powerful statement because we all know what he meant. Because those companies
stand out.
Said that,
right.
Yeah.
And so businesses are really trying hard to be something to somebody and not everybody. And just like he talked about, his business isn't for everybody. That's what our clients are doing as well. And the key is, if I'm going to be about a frosted restroom.
Right.
Then are we executing on a frosted restroom every day, every customer?
Right. You have to be congruent. That's what the customer is looking for.
And consistent.
Right.
You have to execute consistently on these brand standards because, you know, if you miss them, then people start to lose interest and don't find your
delivery. And there's
delivery.
A lot of choices.
That's right. Yeah, think about that. We have a number of, I'll just call them cheeseburger clients. Yeah. And we've got some of the largest in the world. And you think to yourself, where are all the places that you could walk out of this studio right now and go get a cheeseburger?
Right.
And what drives your choice?
Right.
It's not that they sell cheeseburgers. So what is the differentiator for these businesses? And in fact, one of the things that we help brands measure is value. And I can tell you that some of our clients charge $10 for your visit and others charge $5 for your visit. And I won't name names. But in fact, what we find is the value perceived by many of our consumers is actually higher when they pay more because of the perceived value of what they get out of the experience.
So there's obviously a great deal of rigor, structure, depth to your process, but it occurs to me that so much of it must lean on what happens very early in the relationship, early in the engagement cycle. Walk us through like the very beginning pieces of that, if you will, because I'm envisioning a great deal of exchange early on and a great deal of trust having to be developed pretty quickly for me to open up and get
right because it seems like it's a pretty intimate relationship with the company because I got to let you know in order to help me I have to give you the keys to the kingdom here, right?
That's exactly right. And it's not uncommon for a company to contact us and say, you know, we're interested in what you guys are doing. We know we have opportunities. And so perhaps there's a non-disclosure agreement that gets put in place so there can become some of that information sharing. And you know, candidly, we have a lot of secret sauce that we're conveying as well. So there's an information share. And I think, Stone, to answer you really directly, there's two ways that we typically engage. Some companies come to us and go, we don't know what we're doing. We have no clue. You know, we have no measures in place. We have no data. We just know that we'd like to start knowing how we're operating. And so in that case, we will typically develop programs, collaborate with them, try to understand generally, you know, intuitively, what do you think we should be looking at? Hey, here's some best practices. And then we put programs in place to actually start measuring the operational, like I described, as well as the experiential, and start getting feedback. And after about 6 months of data coming back from the business, we can start to use that predictive analytics capability that I was describing earlier, where we can really start to say, aha, here's what's going on in your business. Here's where you have blind spots. You know, I think what we try to do with those companies is, number one, tell them, you know, what matters most to your customers. Number two, where do you have operational or behavioral deficiencies? And thirdly, you know, what's the specific ROI that you can derive if you attack this issue or make this improvement? And so that's one path. The other thing is where a company comes to us and says, hey, we're already on our customer intelligence journey. We're moving along. It may not be getting us exactly where we need to be. I was just with a restaurant organization here in town yesterday, and that's exactly where they are. And they're like, what you just described is way different than what we're doing. Here's all this data that we have. And so we'll, in fact, take their existing data from existing measurement programs and use that integration process that I described and modeling approach and come back and say, well, here's what you should be looking at, and here's the ROI that you could derive. And they may or may not choose to use us. They may continue to use the measurement programs they already have in place. So in some ways, we're a data collection vendor. In other ways, we're an analytics and consulting firm. And in some cases, and mostly the best ones, we're both.
Now, do you ever see like a complete disconnect where the company thinks they're Nordstrom's and they're Walmart?
So, absolutely. It's happened a couple of times in my career, and I've been doing this for about 8 years now. And I will mention one particular cheeseburger company, won't tell you who, that we went to see them, and we actually did a lot of data collection on our own because we felt like we had a really strong business case to share with them about how they were executing and that they really needed help. So we presented results of mystery shops, video shops where we actually videoed people and their execution and or lack thereof, and spent an hour and a half with these executives showing them that, and they were pretty non-impressed. Yeah, tell us something we don't already know, and weren't really compelled to move into a more meaningful conversation with us. And I must admit, it's probably one of the more discouraging meetings I've ever been to. But the point was, is their perception was, well, as long as we don't stink, that's not the word they used. Stink as bad as the operation across the street, we're okay. And, you know, obviously not the right attitude because of the point made earlier. There are so many companies that are executing at such a high level and trying to raise the bar, my pleasure, and that they just settling for the status quo is a loss.
Like good enough. They thought good enough was good enough.
That's right.
So what's on the horizon for MarketForce? Any changes, changes in direction or intensity toward a specific effort?
Yeah, so a couple of things we see in terms of our growth. We're going to be a bigger business than we are today, and that is because of our global expansion. We are currently operating here in North America as well as in Europe, and we are in the UK, France, and Spain in the European market. We'll probably continue to grow in that area. The other thing that we'll be doing is jumping into other industries that we're not currently playing in. So things like transportation, very specific segments of the hospitality space, like hotels, and continue government is another area that we're looking at. And then the third thing is, I think, as we're in mobility. So yes, we have mobile phones and it's a big part of what we do, but continuing to drive on the innovations that we're seeing, and you know, we're all sitting here with our mobile phones and right. We're all looking at them. This is the future of the world. And so making our data collection methodologies work more seamlessly on these devices, allowing our shoppers to use these to interact with us, as well as pushing reporting and analytics information to our clients via these devices in real time, we see that being a very important development for us.
Where can our listeners go to learn more?
So I think to your earlier point, our website is www.marketforce.com. Feel free to call me. I'd be delighted to speak with anybody that's interested in this topic. My number at the office is 770-407-3130. And I'm on LinkedIn as Bradley B. Christian, and I would love to hear from folks.
Fantastic. And you can hand your report in to Karen on your experience here today. But not until Kevin does some of his remaining magic after the show. All right?
Will do.
Hey, hang in there with us. We got one more guest.
Yeah? That'd be great. Yeah.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, Lee, it's the headliner, the ever patient and perfectly polite president and co-founder of Seven Mindsets. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Mr. Jeff Waller. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Awesome to be here. Bradley, I'm thinking a reality TV show might be a marketing strategy for you. It's fascinating, fascinating.
Well, so, I think I saw you getting going on a new book there with these two interviews. You got all kind of great information, right?
Yeah, good research, good research.
Seven Mindsets, intriguing title. Tell us a little bit about this thing.
So we spent, my company, my partners have spent 25 years working with youth, and we started in 1988 teaching entrepreneurship, mostly to inner city youth. If you think about entrepreneurship, you teach that to drug dealers,
they're
gang
entrepreneurs,
members.
Right?
Exactly.
Well, there you go.
So you teach
faculty.
Them. You teach them they can make money and not get shot at, and they're pretty happy. And we did that for many, many years, and in 2006 – we were doing some work for a customer, and we came across a study that showed that depression has increased tenfold since 1960, that 10 wow. times more people are depressed, walking around depressed today than they were in 1960. And the average onset age, the average age in which a person becomes depressed for the first time is now 14.5 years old versus 30 years of age in 1960. And for people who have dedicated their lives to helping youth, that was a really alarming statistic. And we decided that we were going to spend some time and figure out what we needed to do, where the gap was, what wasn't happening, and what we could teach. And so we started a three-year research project that concluded that as a whole, we've gotten pretty good at teaching skill sets, but the missing ingredient is mindsets, that our students are taught very well, but what we're not teaching them is how to think about themselves, their environment, and their future. And when you look at people who have succeeded, people who live meaningful lives, people who have success, what differentiates them is how they think, right? We can look at somebody from the inner city who has a lot less likelihood of coming out of there successful, but we can all point to examples of people who have done that, right? We can look at women who grew up in a culture where they didn't have the same opportunities as men, but we can all point to individuals who have done it. And the reality is that it's not a function of what you know or where you came from. It's really a function of how you think. And through all our research, we distilled that down into seven mindsets, and we wrote a book. And now our mission is really taking that information and getting it to as many young people globally as possible, and that's really what the purpose of our company is.
Now, can you share what the seven mindsets are, or I got to buy the book?
No, I can. Yeah, so the first mindset is everything is possible, and that's really just about expectations, right? We all know the importance of expectations. People who achieve a lot expect to achieve a lot. And it's really important for young people to understand that their life really is what they believe it will be. and it will rise and fall based on the expectations they set for themselves. Passion First, which is my favorite, is really about self-discovery. It just says that, you know, you're unique. You're a unique expression of life. Really, that means that you're capable of doing something that no one else can do. And really what you need to do is figure out what are your strengths, what are your passions, what are your values, what are your desires, and align your life around that and figure out how you can create a vocation that taps in to the things that are really going to fuel your life and tap into the things that are naturally good for you. We are connected as the third. And if you look at people who are successful, every single relationship they have in their life, they see as an opportunity. Every single person from the president to the janitor has a bit of information or something to share that can help that person live their dreams. And that's how they engage with individuals in their life. And when you understand that, that's just so powerful for young people to understand. 100% accountable is just the reality that your life, you're not a product of your history. Your future really isn't predetermined yet. It really is a function of the actions you take and the decisions that you make, and it can be what you want it to be from this moment and every moment moving forward. Attitude of gratitude, you know, I always use the quote for energy flows where attention goes. The things that expand in our life are the things that we focus on, and so we need to focus on the good things. And you know, when bad things happen, if you look at people who have achieved a lot, they will always point to a moment of adversity or great conflict in their life as a catalyst for their ultimate success. And so people who live great lives ultimately look at the adversity in their life as an opportunity for growth. That's where they get the motivation or the bit of knowledge or the bit of awareness that ultimately allows them to be successful. Live to give is the sixth mindset, and that's just all about make your life a life of service. If you want to find meaning in life, you're going to find most of that from the impact you have on others and the impact you have on the environment around you. And the last is the time is now, which is all just about being in the moment. You know, really all we have is this moment. That's where all our power is. All we can ever do is in this moment. And when we can help people understand it's now when you need to start taking that action. It's now when you need to start doing the things that can allow you to achieve the things you want in life. That's a very powerful realization for a lot of people. So those are the seven mindsets.
What a marvelous executive summary. It makes me want to get the book. I'm going to get the book this evening on my Kindle, if it's available on Kindle. I don't know if it is or not.
It is.
If it's not, I'll go to the bookstore.
Okay. It is, yeah.
Yeah, it'll be on my Kindle tonight. That's fantastic. I've got a question to ask you about co-authoring, if we can shift gears here a little bit. Mm-hmm. Some years ago, very early in the self-publishing deal, I wrote a book, but I wrote it by myself. And Mom still has, you know, 500 copies in the garage, you know, out of the 503 that sold. And but what's it like to work with a co-author? Speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's I've been working with Scott since 2002, and you know, it's like anything else. I mean, it's a partnership, and you know, there's a lot of work that goes into it. It's a marriage. You know, there's a lot of you know, things that you have to work through and manage through and ultimately kind of come to some general agreements. And we did that for about the first 5 years of our relationship. But we're at a point now where I think we kind of understand where each other's strengths are and we value those. And I think we're okay that we're not insecure about maybe where the other person's better than the other. And I truly believe the culmination of that, if you do it right, is that the product is ultimately a lot better, right, than each of us could have done individually.
Yeah.
So, but it's a challenge, and there's a lot of ego management involved, and a lot of interesting discussions that have to take place about how the book's written. You know, one of the
did
biggest
you think there should be eight, and he thought there should be seven, and you were like, no, you got to get rid of that one.
No, yeah, there was originally five, and we agreed to add two more, but we've been pretty solid on the number for a while, so.
Now, when you're working with inner city, I was reading an article, I think it was a blog post, that said this girl grew up in the inner city in a project environment, and she was saying that there was so many more resources for a pregnant teenager than there was for a teenager that wanted to go to college.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I'll share a story with you, and we work with an organization here in Atlanta called the City of Refuge, which is a fabulous organization, and they're trying to understand what causes a cycle of poverty in a really at-risk community like the City of Refuge. And their research shows that the single reason the cycle of poverty continues is that every time a girl turns 16 years old, she is pressured to become pregnant, right? She's pressured by her mother and her grandmother to become pregnant so they can get Medicare. Mm. And the City Refuge vision, I don't know where they are on this, was they were going to create a school that would be from 6th grade to 12th grade. Every girl in the community would come there 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and would basically be taught, you know, success, be set up to go to college, and made sure that they didn't become pregnant. And they believe that that would end the cycle of poverty, right? And so that gets a lot to our 100% accountable mindset, in that that really is just a cultural expectation that's been set. But when, if you can get that young girl to look at themselves and understand that they're just so much more valuable, right, than a Medicare check, and there's so much more opportunity on the table for them, and this decision is going to have massive implications on your ability to do the things you want to do with your life. And when you create that awareness, you can get them to start to make different decisions. And it's amazing to me when you say that, because I completely believe it, because it's such an epidemic. You'd be amazed at if you ever looked at the statistics on the percentage of inner city African American boys and their lifespan, or the number of them that go to college, it's a function of single moms, right, and not being brought up in the proper home, so that they're taught the right things, so they can move beyond the gangs and the drugs and get out of there and go on and do the things that they're capable of with their life.
Now, have you seen an impact of when you share these seven mindsets and this, if you can get buy-in, can it really, have you seen it actually change lives?
Yeah, so we've developed a curriculum tool. So our vision is to sort of partner with schools and youth agencies like the YMCA or the Boys and Girls Clubs, and put this content in the hands of teachers and youth leaders to teach it so they can have the impact that we have in our programs. And we did a pilot at a local middle school, and it was with 51 students who were at risk, which means either grades, behavior, or attendance. And the single statistic in Georgia for graduation is the math test score on the CRCT test, which is the state standardized test.
At what grade?
At 8th grade. So that determines if you go on to high school. If you don't pass, you don't go on to high school, you know, your chances drop way down. And so 51 students took this program. Before they took the program, 12 of the 51 had passed the math portion of the course. And after the program, which was 20 weeks, we did it for 30 minutes a week, 41 of the 51 passed the math,
wow,
which was a 250%.
How's that for data, Brad, huh? That's good stuff.
And so, you know, people ask us, what was the math program? What's the math program you taught? It wasn't a math program. What we did was we made math matter to the kids who were taking it. And then they self-determined success, you know, but it was the mindset, you know,
right.
A kid would show up the next day and say, you know, I want to retake that test. He's not good enough. He valued himself more. Now he understood there was a greater opportunity in his life. And that math score was now connected to something of meaning to him.
That is a fantastic story that they made. And for me, the punchline is that it made the math matter.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Connected it to,
and it has to
self-worth.
Be kind of it's self-discovery. Like, you can't tell them that math matters. They have to, on their own, create an environment where they go, math matters, right? That's the key in this.
Yeah, I mean, I could only, you know, a teacher who goes into a room in front of 30 kids who don't give a flip about what she's teaching, it's just got to be a very lonely feeling.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what you do is we call it radical self-interest. So we use a term called radical self-interest. You got to connect things to what really is important to the young person. And so the seven mindsets is designed to do that. And so what happens is they start to see a brighter future, right? They understand that there's a greater possibility out there, and it matters to them now. And now when they start to make decisions, there's now a new criteria. There's a new data point in that decision, right? And so they're going to be more likely to make better decisions that are aligned with a future opportunity that they see for their life. And so a big part of what we do is just help them create that vision, help them believe in it, and help them understand how that translates to what they're doing in the present, right? And then they're going to start making different decisions that are going to benefit them.
Now, how long does that stick with them? Because it's like, you know, I can say I want to lose weight and get all fired up about a diet for a day or two, and then, you know, somebody comes by with chocolate cake and that's out the window.
Yeah.
You know, how do you keep them compliant and along this righteous path?
So a big part of our strategy, we call it the power of suggestion. No matter how good we are in a classroom, we could show you in the past that 90% of the students – that we taught, who we thought we had changed, 2 weeks after they left our program, were acting and behaving exactly like they were acting and behaving 2 weeks prior. Because they go back to the same friends, same family, same environment, and it's real easy to fall back into the same thought processes. So it was important to us to build some things that would allow us to sustain that. And so a big part of that is partnering with schools where the program's not just a week.
Why it has to be every day, right? That's why it has to be 20 weeks straight, because you got to get these habits ingrained and become a lifestyle, not just a class they took or an activity they did.
And you got to start to put them to use, and you got to start to see different results, and you got to start to feel that feeling of accomplishment, and that's going to start to motivate success. And so, we stretch it out through partnerships, but we've also created a product called 7 Mindsets Masterclass, which is all about using technology to continue to deliver this information to people, to create a community where, a community is a big part of this, that they can actually share and discuss and hold each other accountable with folks around the world. And then we do things where we actually try to, ultimately the measure for us is that young person doing something they wouldn't have done that's positive, after we taught them before. And so we have a lot of programs in place that actually drive action. They actually get them to see the feeling they get from doing something of meaning. We have something called the Live to Give Challenge, which is a program we run every year, where kids just go out and do something in the community that they're passionate about. And you'd be amazed. They get out there, they do it. And, that feeling of helping people is so powerful. And you think a kid in the inner city who doesn't think that they have the capacity to help folks, when they get out there and actually do something to help somebody, that's a really important awareness for them, because now they understand that there's people that they can help, that they have a capacity to do things that matter. And that type of activity creates that feeling, which is a big part of the sustainability model that we're trying to build.
What an inspiring conversation. What do you need more of, and how can we help? Do you need more folks in the community, in the business community, in the educational arena supporting you? You need people buying your book? What do you need?
All those are good. All those are good. I think, we just started with our curriculum product last year, and we're having a lot of success. We've put that in about 20 to 30 different schools around the world. We got one in England, about 4 or 5 here in Fulton County. But we're really interested in meeting with principals and counselors, folks that are interested in programs that can really augment what the teachers are teaching in the school. And so, if you're interested, you can visit our website, which is www.7mindsets.com. You can email me at jeff@7mindsets.com. There's a lot of information out there about the different programs that we do, but we're really interested in developing meaningful relationships with folks in the school systems, but also youth agencies like the Boys and Girls Clubs, the YMCAs, United Way are some of the ones that we've been working with.
And then when you say schools, what is it, any elementary, middle, and high school, or is it primarily middle?
Yeah, primarily it's middle. That's the point right now where these young people are starting to make the sort of foundational decisions about their lives. And, it's amazing in sixth grade, the general constructs that kids are building at that age around, how they view drugs, how they view, relationships.
What's possible in life.
That's really where the seeds need to start to be planted. And so that's where we've seen the most success. And middle schools mostly around the country have a lot more flexibility than high schools in sort of scheduling. Our program requires about 30 minutes every week or every other week, which, believe it or not, is pretty tough to get in a high school. But we do have a couple of high schools that are doing this, but it's predominantly middle school. But we also have a curriculum that allows us to introduce this to kids in the 4th and 5th grade, which has been helpful as they move into middle school and it starts to get a little more involved for them.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's 7mindsets.com?
The number 7mindsets.com, yes.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.